Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is the celebrated ceramicist Katharina Klug. Katharina's pottery is known for its elegant, strong and simple forms, meticulously decorated with hand-drawn lines. For these, she uses ceramic pastels that she makes herself. Her signature features are the contrast between her shapes and her colours, particularly a blood-red one that she loves to glaze the inside of her porcelain works with. In fact, ceramics are in her blood. For decades, her mother has been running a pottery business in Austria, where the family comes from. So, Katharina grew up with clay before going on to further her studies in Austria and Germany. She came to the UK nearly 15 years ago, since when she's won many prizes. These include twice winning silver in the Craft and Design magazine's Selected Makers Awards. She's also a member of the prestigious Craft Potters Association. She works from a studio within her home in Cambridge, where I went to speak with her. Katharina Klug, welcome to the podcast. Delighted to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Bob.
Now, we're sitting in your studio, but outside the window is a new studio being constructed. So what will that give you that you haven't got at the moment?
In one word, it's space. I always need more space, and I've been dreaming of this new studio for some years now. It has been in the planning for 5 years. We started construction this summer, and we are almost done.
And so it'll give you a chance to make more pots?
Absolutely. And also to give each process its own space. So pottery is not just on the wheel that you make the shape. You have to let it dry. So that needs space for storage. You need to decorate it, and you need space for all the glazes you apply later on. The equipment is very large as well. So I have several wheels and several kilns, and they take up quite a bit of space. The materials, the clay is heavy and bulky. Pretty much anything needs space.
Are you advancing technologically as well, or just putting the sort of things, you know, but in bigger quantities?
It will be the same equipment, but with more space. And I am thinking of putting a spray booth in as well, a new one, which will be an upgrade. But also I'm thinking of a larger kiln.
Right, right. So larger kiln, larger pots?
Yes, definitely.
Now, Katharina, you're from a potting family, aren't you? You grew up in Austria and your mother was a potter.
That's right. She started her pottery in the mid-70s, and then I was born, and she started her business and hasn't stopped since.
Were you playing with clay as a child?
Yes, my brother and I were very much encouraged to play with clay and to make things, and they would be then also sold in the family gallery. That was our pocket money, basically.
Right, and can you remember the first thing you threw?
I think it was something like, you could say it was a bowl. It could hold maybe some fluid.
Right. You wouldn't want to eat your breakfast cereal from it.
Yeah. I guess it was a bit on the wobbly side, for sure.
Did you ever think about taking over your mum's business?
Well, that was very much her dream. She encouraged my brother and me to become her successors and taking over the family business. And that was very much the plan until I met this really friendly, handsome English chap.
Oh, right. Well, he changed the course of your career, did he?
Yes, in a way. We got married, and we basically settled in Cambridge, which suited his career in technology, and also, actually, Cambridge is fantastic for pottery, for a potter to work.
Well, you've got the Fitzwilliam Museum, which is full of old ancient Korean pots. Are they a big influence?
Indeed, absolutely. That I couldn't believe what sort of pots are on show in the Fitzwilliams, and also we have Kettle's Yard, we have the Anthropology Museum. I mean, there's so much. I don't even need to go to London for some inspiration. It's just all here.
However, before you came here, Katharina, you went to art school in both Austria and Germany. Your focus was obviously ceramics, was it?
It was from the start, really. Like I said, my mother very much... I mean, there wasn't even a discussion on what else I could do in life. It was just pottery was in the cards, and I didn't look at any other colleges. And to be honest, at that young stage... I didn't even know what else I would rather do. So I went with the flow. And I did have a phase where after my first degree, I thought, am I really sure to do this for the end of my life? And I tried to get sort of a clean job, a 9-to-5 with a proper paycheck. But I really didn't take to it very much, and I quit after a few months, and I have never looked back.
Was that in the ceramics industry?
No, actually, I worked for a charity in Austria in an office job, and I thought, clean blouse and 9-to-5 and a free weekend sounds great, but yeah, it didn't suit me.
No, you prefer something that can get clay all over. Mm.
Yes, dirty clothes every day, pretty much. Yes.
When you were doing your studies in Austria and Germany, did you learn anything about the business side of the work as well? I mean, presumably your mother would have taught you something about that.
Because the family was always so involved in my mother's business, the day to day, how to interact with customers, how to do fairs, how to have an exhibition, I already knew that and then I did work experience, I did apprenticeships on top of my degrees as well. So I think it was always there. My degrees were very much, particularly the first one was all about learning more about the material, what the material does in heat and what the material does through all the processes and how I can positively manipulate this material.
And were you talking of porcelain then or all sorts of things?
First, it was more stoneware and earthenware. I truly believe one should know how to throw a pot in stoneware and earthenware first before you embark on porcelain. Porcelain is quite a different animal. It's a clay that is formulated from different ingredients, and it behaves quite differently, and you really have to have a good understanding of the throwing process to use porcelain.
But it gives you that opportunity to make things much thinner, doesn't it?
You can make thin things out of stoneware equally. It's what it does do is if you make it very fine, it becomes slightly translucent when fired. But also what it does is it's very bright. It has no impurities. So it's a very white clay. And if you put a glaze on top or a decoration, you get a stronger color and you get a very clear, clean surface to work with.
And do you get your porcelain here in the UK?
Yes, since I moved here, before then I would use French porcelain, which was sort of easier to buy in Germany. But here, when I came, I switched to porcelain from Stoke-on-Trent. The ceramics industry is very well supported through Stoke-on-Trent. You get all the kilns, all the materials from there.
In 2014, you were selected for the Craft Council's Hothouse program. What did that entail?
Oh, that was a fantastic program. I was so lucky to get into that. Well, it was supported by the Crafts Council. We, a group of hopeful craftspeople of all kinds, not just potters, but also printmakers and textile artists and all sorts of disciplines, were brought together, and we were taught lessons on how to present ourselves, how to sell our work, how to be part of the creative industries. And it also gave us the opportunity to connect with each other, but also with mentors and people who already made it in the industry. And through that, I met Chris Keenan, who is a fantastic potter who I admired many, many, many years before that program, and was lucky to be paired up with him. He would meet with me and share, you know, knowledge and insight. It was fantastic.
Of course, one of the great potters of the last century was Lucy Rhee, who, like you, was originally Austrian and came to the UK. I think she's been a big influence on you, hasn't she?
Yes, very much so. When I did my degree in Austria, her work was already a topic, and I think I even wrote a paper about her for my degree. And her designs, her simple approach to the vessel, and also how she used lines to decorate her work had a huge impact on my work.
And earlier this year, the Kettle's Yard Gallery had an exhibition of her work, and I believe that they commissioned you to make some pots that were influenced by her.
Yes, the director of Kettle's Yard, Andrew Nadir, he asked me whether I would make a limited edition of bowls that would be a sort of a celebration of Lucy Rhee's work, but interpreted in my technique and how I make my pots. Yeah, that was a great project, and yeah, really successful. I was very happy to be involved.
And how does your technique differ from hers?
Well, she applied her lines in a sgraffito technique, where you scrape into the clay or through the glaze or through the slip, where I apply my lines on top. So I make my lines with an implement that I call an oil stick or an oil crayon, which I formulate myself out of ceramic materials and waxes and oils. It gets melted and then molded into something that I can hold in my hand. And then I apply line by line onto the bisque-fired pot, whereas she would have already done her decoration when the pot was still raw, and she would only fire it once.
And what inspires those lines, Katerina?
Well, I believe pretty much anything, if you look in your environment, pretty much everything is made up of lines, whether that is a fence, a plant, the outline of a building, the lines on wood. I mean, literally the floor. I there is nothing that isn't a line for me.
Mm. Now, you also got an Arts Council research grant, didn't you, which you used to go to Japan. Now, that must have been one hell of a trip.
Boy, that was something, yes.
Is the ceramics industry almost ingrained in Japanese culture, do you think?
I would say so. I mean, I met taxi drivers and restaurateurs who have collections of pottery and showed me very proudly what they collected over the years. It's so part of the culture, and the in general, the craft sector is so highly valued. The skill of a craftsman has the same value as a famous painter painting, where I think in the West there is still a dividing line between the arts and the crafts.
Yes, and craft is looked down upon a little, isn't it?
A little bit. Mm. It's alone you see it in the prices that paintings and prints reach, where you know, pots you can pick up, you know, really good pots you can pick up still for under £1,000.
What did the trip to Japan teach you in terms of how did you take its influences to your work?
So the plan was to go there and to do research on a new wax that I wanted to use as a main ingredient for the new crayons I formulated. But it wasn't just that. I also, after lockdown, after having two children, and that makes you very domestic and keeps you in the house, I needed new input and new influences. And I mean, most potters dream of Japan, and so have I for many years. So I thought that is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to actually go and talk to potters, but also see collections of pottery and to see how they present the work and make the work, and also the visual language, the aesthetics is so strong. I'm still feeding off this. I mean, it was only 10 days, but no, it was almost 2 weeks, but it had a huge impact on me.
And what about shapes?
There are beautiful traditional shapes that, so there are certain, obviously the Japanese pottery has been collected in Europe for a very long time, so I have seen examples of traditional Japanese pots before, and I think that already had an impact on what I've made up to that point. But then I saw even more examples, and the Minge movement that I encountered in Mashiko and then in Kyoto again really surprised me. I thought they were very much sort of brown slipware pots like Bernard Leach would make in the 60s, and I thought that wasn't quite what I was looking for. But then there were some absolutely amazing, vibrant pots with color, with exciting, very very modern looking shapes, in fact. I was really impressed.
And the patterns too, did you bring back any Japanese patterns?
Yes, I did. Particularly the architecture has left an impression. So a lot of traditional but also modern buildings are clad in wood, and they apply patterns. Also the woodwork in general made up of so many line patterns. And I took photos after photos. I think I took in total 4,000 photos in that short period of time, and I'm still processing, I'm still going through them and see how I can take them and make them into my own.
You mentioned color just then. When I first saw your ceramics some time ago, the thing that struck me first was this blood red interior of your pots. That's sort of become your signature almost, hasn't it?
It has, yes. And I see it very much as a so the vessel in itself is for me a strong symbol of the human body. Alone the word vessel we associate it with the body, but also with a container. And then we have all sorts of words for parts of a vessel, like the neck and the foot ring and the belly and so on. So for me, the inside, to make it blood red, to even go closer to that analogy of the human body, is something I appreciate. And then making a good red in ceramic is actually technically quite challenging. The height, if you fire it to high temperatures, which what you have to do with porcelain, you have to go to, well, I go to 1260 degrees minimum. That's when often the bright colors go dull, and you have to sort of find a way to work around it, how to get a vibrant red. So I developed that glaze after college. We did a lot of chemistry. It was a very strong part of my education.
What is glaze? What are the ingredients of glaze?
Glaze is basically a mixture of stains and earth metals and feldspar, quartz, and things like cobalt would make something blue, and iron would make something red in reduction, but brown if you fire it in an oxidation. A simple recipe would maybe have three or four ingredients, but some of my glazes are made up of 15 individual powders. That you have to weigh very carefully together, because a little bit more of one or the other can make it run, or can make it craze, or can make it become a completely different color. So there's a lot of, and then what it does in the heat, and how they interact in the heat together, these ingredients. It's a bit like baking. I would say, you know, if you get too much sugar, it's no good. If you have too little, it's no good. So you have to approach it very methodically and really keep good notes.
The other thing about your pieces is you like contrast, don't you? Contrast both in color and in shapes, I suppose.
That's right. I believe that from the moment we are born, what babies can see first is contrast, you know, black and white, and then color comes on top of it. But I think strong contrasts really make the pot sort of, I suppose my pots don't try to hide in the background. I think they want to be looked at, and the pattern really grabs you. Yes, I think that's right.
Well, let's take that vase over there. Could you possibly take me through briefly sort of how you make it from the clay onwards, really?
Certainly. So I use porcelain, as I already mentioned, as my main clay. And it needs first kneading, almost like a dough. You knead it so that the molecules of the clay are mixed up, that the clay is not hard and soft. It needs to be very homogeneous. Then I weigh out the right amount for the clay, the shape and the size I have in mind. Then I create a nice round ball of clay, and then I go to my wheel. So you sit on the wheel, you have a pedal that makes it spin.
Going. Oh, I thought it was all electric.
It is electric. It is electric, but it is like a gas pedal, basically. You go on it to make it fast and stop and slow down and so on. And then you throw the ball in the middle of the wheel head, and then hands on with a little bit of water, you center it. You basically you make sure that nothing sticks out anymore. It's just running true, running smooth. And then you can open it up and bring up the shape. And that's when you start forming the form you have in mind. And you have, I have lots and lots of tools. I mean, this is just a tiny amount of tools you can see here. The garage is full of tools. It's a bit of a obsession. Whenever I go anywhere, I buy tools, and I'm looking for. I brought a whole suitcase back from Japan, believe it or not. And I make tools, and even a hardware shop could hold most interesting implements that can be used for pottery. It's so you can use all these tools to manipulate the shape. I specialize in shapes that have really nice curves, and I often go in quite accentuate sort of the neck of the piece, bring out maybe a top shape and a bottom shape separately, again to sort of maybe it reminds you of the human body of the shape of a woman. I have a lot of shapes that actually named after people, or in general I call them ladies, or I call them friends, or I call them women, or so the shape is then determined, and you cut it off with a wire from the wheel. You put it on the side. It needs, now it's still very soft and it needs to dry for a while before you can apply the next step, which is the turning of it. So if in my case all my pots have on the base a really nice foot ring, and that is something you would carve out with turning tools. So you turn your pot upside down, you put it in something that is called a chuck that holds it firmly on the wheel head, and then you would use carving tools to carve out on the wheel the bottom shape. Again, after that, it dries to a point where it's completely dry. There's no more moist in it, apart from the chemically bound one. And then you would, for the first time, fire it. This is called the bisque firing. That only goes up to about 900 to 1,000 degrees. That already makes it technically ceramics. But if you want it, so the glaze firing is then higher. That comes later, after the decorating part.
So you put your glaze on and fire it again?
That's correct, yes. And the lines I would apply on the bisque fired pot. So after the first firing, it comes out. It's sort of slightly pinkish. It already sounds like ceramics, but it's still rough. And you apply the lines onto that surface.
And you apply them with your wax crayon or something.
That's right.
And freehand, because imperfection makes it different. It makes it much more exciting than, say, a mass-produced one.
Indeed. That is exactly how I approach it. For me, the hand-drawn line I'm human. The decoration is human. It's not perfect. I could do it with all sorts of techniques to make it absolutely perfect. I could use a ruler. I could screen print it. I could apply it already. I could do it in a mold. I mean, there are so many ways of doing lines. But for me, it would take out the interest and the nature of the technique.
So it gives it character.
Yes, I think so. And you always find something, you know, the imperfection makes you look at it over and over because you see different things in it all the time.
Is there any element of not sure what it's going to turn out like? Is it planned 100% or is there an element of accident in there?
There is, I would say, with my technique and how I sort of specialized in a certain area of there's so many techniques in ceramics you could do. Because of the specialization, I think I could say to 80% what the outcome is. But the kiln always has the last laugh, in a good way and a bad way. Grayson Perry said it quite nicely, you have to control your expectation. You never know what's the outcome.
You mentioned that you make things in human form, and in fact, some of your works are almost like a family, aren't they, when they're put together?
That's right. I really like to group them. Individual pieces has its own interest, but once you have a group of them, the forms somehow speak to each other and create a thing that is more than its individual pieces.
Yeah, there's one I think called Taking a Viewpoint or something.
Yes.
Where you've got three people, they're obviously discussing something.
Yes, exactly. They have a relationship, they have something, you know, there's some conversation going on. Indeed. I think I will do more of these things. I really enjoy how they become something else, a grouping, a landscape, a cityscape, a family or
Do you enjoy making things that aren't necessarily functional?
Yeah, so all my pots can be used and can be filled with fluids and can be even put in a dishwasher or a microwave, but it's not my focus. I'm not making my shapes to make them the most practical item in your kitchen, because for me the form and the design comes first. That is what interests me. And I myself collect pottery, and I barely use any of them, if I'm very honest. I just want to look at them. I want to handle them. They are for me. They equal a print or a sculpture. I just love to look at them and to enjoy them.
Although I have to say, you did offer me a cup of coffee in one of them.
Oh yes, for the house I make some mugs and I make some, you know, occasionally maybe a flower pot for my mother-in-law or, like I say, they can, and I have some teapots and they are functional and they can hold hot tea and they actually pour reasonably well, and I make tea bowls as well. And I learned how to do that, and I want the vessel to have integrity as such, but I wouldn't compromise over a shape. So some of the shapes are really going in and out quite strongly, and you wouldn't fit many flowers into them, but I don't think that's the point. No. Necessarily.
Let me give you a quote of yours. You say, year by year, I come closer to make the porcelain vessels I dream of. What are the ones you dream of that you haven't made yet?
Well, it's, you know, year by year, my skill improves. Of course, at college, you learn the basics. A craft never stops. The skill level and the proficiency and the knowledge grows and grows. And that I really believe that will never stop. I think I will make my best pot maybe possibly before I, you know, walk off this mortal coil. I mean, unless my body, you know, that's the other problem. You fight against, I'm now 45 since yesterday, and I can feel that my body is, you know, not aging as such, but I need to do things to keep strong and to keep my back in shape to to lift the heavy things. And so there is sort of, I think there is a point where my skill level and my body will fight with each other. But I do believe there's always progress. It doesn't stagnate. It never stops. It there will always be a better pot.
Well, Katerina, good luck and keep those dreams going.
Thank you so much.
Katerina Klug, and good luck with her soon-to-be new studio. Thanks so much for listening. Join me, Bob Chaundy, to consider more art next week.